I think everybody else. Oh, and Ross, you're new too. So, so today, this session I've entitled Rearranging the Furniture, Making This Place Home. And we're going to look at an author named Mary Wilkins Freeman. But first, I'll have you just talk a little bit about what makes you feel at home. And are there things that you have to have in your environment in order to feel at home? Or can you feel at home anywhere? Or how does that, talk about your sense of home a little bit, anybody who would like to.
Are you talking about physical things or people or anything?
Anything.
Anything, okay. Well, I think certainly a sense of being welcomed, as I think just an openness and a welcome and glad you're here, you know, since that the person who's invited you is glad that you're with them and you can feel at home.
So you can feel at home pretty much anywhere as long as you feel a sense of welcome.
I'm just gonna stop it. No, not necessarily. I gotta think of some more stuff.
I'd say familiarity and routine. Because you can stay someplace long enough to where you become familiar with it, and you get into a little bit of some kind of routine, and it feels like your home.
I would add creature comforts. I'm a person who doesn't like to be cold, and my experience with outdoor bathrooms has not always been good.
Yeah. So creature comforts, yeah. How about anybody have a need for certain things being in a certain place? Or?
I noticed when my mother and I were traveling one year after I was an adult, and we were staying in a motel room, and we were both rearranging the furniture. And I've noticed I always do that. I always make it mine. And she always made it hers, and we were sometimes conflicted there when we were traveling together.
Interesting.
Physical.
Yeah. Answering. I like order, so, I mean, even here, when we settled into our chalet, I had to hang up some things on the hangers and put things in drawers and kind of, so that things had their place. The first time I was really aware of the necessity of a particular environment was when we had been living in Sioux Falls, which is our home, for a few years, and we had been living in a particular neighborhood, an older neighborhood, with lots of trees and just kind of this very homey feel to it. And then we had one child at the time, and then we adopted twins and got pregnant immediately after, and we quickly outgrew our cute little house in this cute little neighborhood. So we moved to a different area of town that was newer and had, you know, just little seedlings for trees. And we lived there for 3 years, and I never felt at home there, ever. Even though it was my house and we had painted, you know, rooms and our furniture was all there, I never felt at home, and I never realized before how important a place was to me in order to feel at home. So as soon as we could, we moved back to
to their
neighborhood.
For neighbors.
Trees and just a different, just has a different sense about it, a different way of being in that part of town, and I just appreciate it so much more. The stories that we'll read today are largely about women sort of arranging space the way that they need it to be in order to feel at home and to make it their own. In order for them to be sort of free to say, I think. That's a phrase I've run across in my research of these women writers, is that they felt that they needed to be free to say whatever it is that they wanted to say, and that having the right kind of space from which to do that was important. So just a little sort of historical and theoretical background to that idea is that at the end of the 19th century, things are shifting from how they were earlier in that century, where prior to that, right, everything took place in the home. The work and the schooling and the eating and the sleeping and everything took place in the home. And then you have this industrialization that take men out, especially men, mostly men, out of that space and into a public work place. And so what developed are what some scholars call these two separate spheres. So you have the public sphere, which is largely where men are working and functioning, and then you have the private sphere, which is the home or the domestic sphere, and that is women's space. And men come from the public space at the end of the day into the domestic space in order to gain sort of a respite and a breather, but then they go back. But the women, right, primarily stayed here in this domestic private space. Scholars tend to talk about those as two very distinct and different spaces. I think, in the way that I read some of this literature, is that there's an overlap. I tend to think of it as a Venn diagram, right, where you have these two circles, and there's an overlapping space in there where the public and the private meet in some way, and that merging of the two spaces, I would say, creates a third space, a different kind of space that is neither public nor private at the same time that it is both public and private, or both public and domestic. So these stories are pretty domestic, really, I think you'll see, which might be a little upsetting because we're reading Mary Wilkins Freeman, it's the end of the 19th century. You think, shouldn't you be moving these women out of this domestic space and give them a different kind of space from which to speak and say? And why are you putting them very tightly into this homey domestic space? So we can talk about that once we've taken a look at that and see what she's doing exactly. Or at least, maybe not exactly, but at least come up with some ideas about what she might be doing. So a few things about Mary Wilkins Freeman. She is another New Englander. She lived in Massachusetts and Vermont primarily. She spent her life in very close connection with female, in a female circle. She had two best friends, one of whom she lived with for 20 years after her sisters and her mother had died. So she lived with this best friend, Mary Wales. And then finally, when she was about 49, she finally agreed to marry a man, Charles Manning Freeman, and their marriage did not last a particularly long time. And critics have said that the novel writing that she does after being married is inferior to the writing that she did prior to. That once she got married, she somehow felt beholden to a very traditional kind of plot that she had not necessarily addressed in her earlier work. So that's interesting. She was quite accomplished in her day. She hung out with Hamlin Garland and William Dean Howells and Rudyard Kipling and other, you know, very established and well-known authors of the time. She had lots of correspondence with Sarah Orne Jewett, another famous regionalist writer that we've looked at. She sat next to Mark Twain at his 70th birthday celebration. She had, you know, sort of a seat of honor there. And in 1926, she was awarded the Howells Medal for Fiction from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. So in her lifetime, she was quite accomplished. In fact, along with Edith Wharton, she was among the first women to be elected to membership in the National Institute of Arts and Letters. And the bronze doors that are the entrance to that building that were installed in 1938 say, dedicated to the memory of Mary Wilkins Freeman and the women writers of America. So she was sort of considered this forerunner among American women writers. And yet, How many of you know her name?
No.
You know, I mean, just interesting that she was published in Harper's Bazaar and all these, you know, great accomplishments in her lifetime that kind of went by the wayside as the canon was developed, the literary canon, you know, that is the one that we know and love, but that excluded some of these great women writers who were writing at the same time as some of these other male writers. So, we're going to look at two stories today by her, and so this is just a little snippet of a story, so let me give you a little lead into it. So this is a story called A Church Mouse, and the story opens with Hetty, who is the main character, hearing from Caleb Gale, the antagonist in the story. The story opens with him saying, "No one ever heard of a woman being a church sexton." That's the first line of the story. And she launches into this, you know, justification of why that would be perfectly acceptable and what's the problem. And he has all these arguments against why this would not be a good idea. And she comes back at him with an answer for every single one until he finally says, "Well, if you were, he's concerned that she won't be able to ring the bell, and she can't possibly sweep the entire church." And she kind of looks at him like, "Duh, what do you think I've been doing my whole life, is cleaning house?" And then he finally says, "Well, where will you live?" And that's when we learn that that's the rub. That's the rub, because the issue is that Hetty has been living as an in-home servant to an older woman in her house for most of her life. And she's been taking care of this home and this woman who now has died. And because the woman did not pay taxes on her home, the town has taken the house, and basically kicked Hetty out of the house, and she has nowhere to go. We also learn that Hetty is a very difficult person, to the point that nobody wants to take her in. All right, so she's kind of a matriarch of this town, but nobody is willing to take her in. And in fact, she keeps saying to people, "It seems that everybody has company right now." And in such a way that she knows very well that nobody has company, they just won't take her in. And her argument is, "You people are obligated to care for me. And we have no almshouse here in our town. We have no poorhouse. So I'm just going to live in the church," she says. "That's where I will live, is in the church." And Caleb Gale says, "Well," because she also says to him, "How about if I come home with you?" And he says, "Well, I don't think my wife would like that. We have company coming." So he finally says, "Yes, I think the church would be a fine place for you to be until we can find another place for you." And so then she says, "Well, as long as I'm living there, I might as well be the church sexton," which was my initial, you know. So she sort of earns this position as the church sexton, and Freeman describes, you know, so that's on a Friday, and so Saturday morning, or no, it's on Saturday, so on Sunday morning she goes to ring the bell, and she says, you know, it's kind of this strange clanging that isn't quite ringing quite right, but okay. So Hetty lives in the church for 3 months without really any problem, and she sets up her home in a little corner of the church. She has a little quilt, sunflower quilt, Wilkins says, that she kind of hangs to section off her little area. And she keeps the church cleaner than it's ever been before. People are very impressed with the way the church looks. But then they decide that's kind of enough of that, probably. So, let's see, I don't want to get you too far in. I want to make sure I stop in the right place. Okay, and I think that's pretty much where we leave off. Yes, so go ahead and read that first page that you have in front of her, in front of you, the first side. That's it for now, yeah. So, what are your observations about this little snippet of the story, and then we'll get to the end, I'll tell you the end of the story.
It's a very nice sentence. Okay.
What strikes you about that?
The fact that it's the women who smell it.
Yeah. He had not smelt the cabbage until his wife nudged him and mentioned it. Neither had Caleb Gale.
Nonetheless.
Right. They have. Yeah, other things, other observations.
Is this the beginning?
This is the middle. This is the middle.
There's more to follow.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as if the minister is doing everything he can to keep her satisfied.
Yeah. He's kind of leaving her little wax.
It sounds so gross. It sounds like they're fairly forgiving of her wool flowers and her little things that she puts around to decorate the church
mm-hmm.
to make it more her home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Some of it just sounds really not so good.
Well, not at all, but that's where she gets in trouble.
Yeah.
And then it might look like potpourri.
I like this line. They had crude taste.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let it go. Yeah.
And then maybe she knows better, right? Maybe she has better taste than they have. Anyway, but yeah. Other things you notice.
is very creative, and they're not really open. I have this definition of humility, which is teachable,
yeah.
Or open to other ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems like a lot of their objections is that she's going against the norm of what they're used to.
Yeah, they're against all their ideas of church decorum, right? It says in that first line, and there's another great line about that, if I can locate that quickly.
And that still goes on today. There are cults that have been in the church for some years, and somebody has been down. We don't know who.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm also wondering, would they be cautious of the fact that she would make this so much her home that it wouldn't be the church anymore?
Yeah, at what point, right. So what is the cost of Hetty having a place to be to the rest of the village?
Well, it sounds like she kind of took over.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
No, that I was just going to sort of say that. Yeah.
She does kind of take over.
Yeah.
Yeah, she definitely does. Although she's still kind of cornered off, but yes, it's sort of... It's
spreading.
Leaking out, right?
They won't take her individually, they'll take her corporately.
Say more about that. What do you mean?
Well, none of them want to take her as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
So they are now having to accept her corporately.
Yeah, right.
Everyone is going to have to share home.
Yes, because they won't take her into their homes.
Mm-hmm.
She now is sort of taking them into her own, right?
Oh.
I mean, the church becomes hers, and they all meet there.
And I think that the cabbie for the Saturday night dinner that's still wafting through the sanctuary, a woman would say, I smell dinner. I don't know that is that domestic. It is sort of that domestic place that maybe a man would think about so much.
Mm-hmm.
And she's domesticating in a way this little church for herself. So, and they could sense, and even she's cooking her meals here. This is her house.
Yeah.
Do you picture her using just a hot plate or something? Do you think there's a kitchen?
She has a little stove in there. Let's see. In fact, at one point, Caleb Gale says to her, or says, today his dignity was supported by important witnesses. Did you bring that stove and bedstead here? Hetty nodded.
Oh, yeah.
What made you do such a thing? And she says, what was I going to do if I didn't?
Yeah.
How's a woman as old as me going to sleep in a pew and go without a cup of tea?
Oh, great. I love that.
That's true.
You know. So she has definitely set up, I was going to say set up shop, but that's not at all what she's done.
She's set up home.
She has set up home. And so there she is, and now they're going to have to deal with it. What you pointed out about the women noticing becomes a very important part of the story. Because what happens next is that, Caleb says, something's got to be done. And the story continues. In the afternoon of the next Thursday, Caleb and the other two selectmen waited upon Hetty in her tabernacle. They stumped up the gallery stairs, and Hetty emerged from behind the quilt and stood looking at them, scared and defiant.
Mm.
Scared and defiant. The three men nodded stiffly. There was a pause. Caleb Gale motioned meaningly to one of the others, who shook his head. Finally, he himself had to speak. Right? So nobody else wants to confront her. I'm afraid you find it pretty cold here, don't you, Hetty? He said. No, thank you. It's very comfortable. Replied Hetty, politely. It ain't very convenient for you to do your cooking here, I guess. It's just as convenient as I want. I don't find no fault. Well, I guess it's rather lonesome here some nights, ain't it? I'd enough sight rather to be alone than have company any day. I mean, she just will not bite. She will not bite on his efforts to... What he's trying to do is get her back out. So they finally say that they found a place for her.
Uh-huh.
That another woman in the community has offered, probably been, arm twisted to take her in. And Hetty doesn't want to live with this other woman because she doesn't like her. So she says, no, thank you. I think I'll stay right here. This will work out just fine for me. And it's going along just swimmingly. So they kind of give up again. The men don't know what to do with that. And so finally, it becomes apparent that they are going to force her out of the church. I mean, they're going to just kind of physically drag her out. And she becomes aware that this is a situation, and so she locks the door to the church while she is inside. And so Freeman writes, the project of forcing the door was urged. One man started for a crowbar. And Caleb Gale's wife says to another woman standing next to her, because now the whole town is sort of gathered, as it might in a small community, to see what's going to transpire here. His wife says, they are a parcel of fools to do such a thing. And she says, it's a perfectly good door. Why are they going to ruin it with a crowbar? Right? Well, it turns out that his wife has the key. Caleb Gale's wife has the key to the church. And she sends her daughter home to get the key. So it becomes very much about sort of this female community sort of rallying behind Hetty. And Hetty's calling out, she's calling out from inside the church. She finally says, just let me say one word, just one word, Hetty says, to the community that has now gathered. And now she kind of gives a sermon. She says, And Mrs. Gale says, say all you want to, Hetty, and don't be afraid, she tells her. I just want to say a word, repeated Hetty. Can't I stay here nohow? It don't seem as if I could go to Miss Radway's. That's the arrangement they made. I ain't nothing again her. I suppose she's a good woman, but she's used to having her own way, and I've been living all my life with them that was, and I've had to fight to keep a footing on the earth, and now I'm getting too old for it. If I can just stay here in the meeting house, I won't ask for nothing any better. I shan't need much to keep me. I won't never a hefty eater, and I'll keep the meeting house just as clean as I know how. And I'll make some more of them wool flowers. I'll make a wreath to go on the whole length of the gallery if I can get wool enough. Won't you let me stay? I ain't complaining, but I've always had a dreadful hard time. Sorry, I don't know why I'm getting emotional.
Yeah!
Seems as if I now might take a little comfort, the last of it, if I could stay here. Hetty covered her face with her hands. Her words ended in a weak wail. Then Mrs. Gale's voice rang out clear and strong and irrepressible. Of course you can stay in the meeting.
Oh. Yay!
Right? And so they all gather around. And then it says, Mrs. Gale stood majestically and looked defiantly around. Tears were in her eyes. Another woman edged up to her. Why couldn't she have that little room side of the pulpit where the minister hangs his hat?
Oh,
she whispered. He could hang it anywhere else. Right? So it becomes this thing where the community of women rallies around Hetty, this woman that they would not take into their home. And they say, of course, you can stay. But let's talk for a minute about what Freeman might be doing here, because it is a very domestic space that Hetty has created for herself. And wouldn't we, now that we're coming up to the 20th century, rather have Hetty in a more public space? Mm. Wouldn't we rather, as, you know, sort of future feminists, have her inhabiting a different kind of space that isn't so domestic? I feel like in some ways, scholars and critics are resistant to that. They get upset that she's created this very domestic space. What is your take on that? What is your impression of what Freeman might be doing? Mm-hmm.
They're resistant. Could you say that again?
I think critics and scholars would like.
What do you mean in a more public place?
They would like to have her, you know, striking out on her own, you know, doing something more public, rather than having created just another domestic space.
Oh.
that she's still there, being very feminine and very domestic. Or is she?
She's, oh, go ahead. No, you go ahead, I'll talk.
I was just thinking that the domestic space is layered with sacred space.
Mm-hmm.
And so it says something about the sacredness of domestic space
mm-hmm.
that perhaps we should honor,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to not, to
mm-hmm.
think that that feminism might mean, for example, that you have to be without the one to have the other.
Or has she taken domestic space into the public space?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, whose responsibility is it? Is it the women or is it the men that are responsible for someone that needs that? Is that not what she's getting at?
Well, I don't know. Say more.
Well, I'm just wondering whether it's the women's responsibility to take care of Hattie, or like you think about an older person who needs care, whose responsibility is it? And I'm thinking about the switch and or the change that has come about in our society of the older folks being tucked away into a public space.
Yeah.
But maybe that's not what she's
yeah.
saying here, but that's what's happened. But the men, were they against having Hattie in the home, or was it always the woman? I'm not sure if I got...
Of taking her in? Nobody wants her.
Nobody wants her, but it sounds to me like it is the women
that
are saying they don't really want her in the home. They have guests.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so the men just go along with that.
Yeah.
But then the woman turns tail,
mm-hmm.
and now they want
to... So would the man be willing to have her in the home? I was wondering if the woman would say it's okay for her to come in.
Yeah.
And she has integrated her home space into her workspace, doing a job that no woman has ever done before.
Yeah.
Yes. Well said.
In a way, this,
yeah.
for this time in history, this is pretty progressive.
Yeah.
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 Sure.
Yeah. Being a sexton, who ever heard of a woman sexton?
Yeah. Yeah.
She is a model for what all women would. So she would be threatening. I'm
mm-hmm.
guessing that these women
taking care of herself.
She certainly is, when nobody else will, right?
Next, they'll want the vote.
Exactly.
They want the church, they want the
it's
vote.
It's a slippery slope.
Did anyone else go to the session? How to handle a disruptive worshiper?
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. No, I wish I had.
It sort of fits in, doesn't it?
It's an echo, you know.
Yeah.
What do you do with someone?
Doesn't fit in.
Yeah. And the thing about Hattie, too, I mean, aside from being an elderly person and a poor person, because the other thing we learned in the story is that much of the work that she's done when she lived in the house with this woman was without pay. So she really has no money either.
Mm-hmm.
So she's elderly and she's poor, but because she's elderly and poor and difficult to get along with, she is this very marginalized person in the community. And she is on the outside. And what Freeman is doing with this story is making her the very center of the community,
yeah.
living in the church,
well,
which is
perfect.
The center
yeah.
of the community, right? And so that the community is hinged upon, and the vitality, I think, of the community is dependent upon bringing the marginalized into the center, right?
What's their moral obligation?
And so the story ends like this. Now it's Christmas time.
Oh no.
And Hattie, it says
the wreath.
Yes, the wreath. Never before had a Christmas bell been rung in this village. Hattie had probably never heard of Christmas bells. She was prompted by pure, artless enthusiasm and grateful happiness. Her old arms pulled on the rope with a will. The bell sounded peal on peal. Down in the village, curtains rolled up, letting in the morning light. Happy faces looked out of the windows. Hattie had awakened the whole village to Christmas Day.
Oh, that's beautiful. Isn't that beautiful?
You know, so she truly does become good grief. I love these stories so much. She truly does become the center of the community and
awakening.
That sense of awakening.
Awakening the people of what's important.
Yeah. So, it's beautiful.
What year
was this? 1889.
Oh, So there was no safety net except Tom's house, his poor house.
Right.
So this is really setting stage for a change of a whole awareness of what do you do with other people.
And an awareness of community. And again, I mean, part of what regionalism does is set up sort of region against nation, right? And if nation is the world, right? If the whole of the nation is sort of how we look at the outside world, the real world, the public space, and region is some parceled off place in the midst of that, right? That it also suggests that region is as important to the whole of the nation, right, as marginalized Hetty is important to the whole of the community. And so the work that these women writers are doing at that time of bringing the marginalized into the center and saying, look, this is nation, right? This is nation right here, where we have this community functioning together and taking care of its own and that kind of thing. Isn't that a model? For what the whole of the nation should be functioning.
And this is also a time when temperate movements were beginning to grow, where women were beginning to become activists,
yes,
not just passive spectators.
Absolutely.
And so you're seeing this as part of a whole shift in the recognition that women have great powers if they would merely exercise it as only women.
Right.
That's
how
you go.
And
she does. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and again, to come back to sort of what I began with, this notion of being free to say, right? And Hetty is finally free to say, but really only when the support, I mean, yes, she's been arguing with Caleb Gale throughout the story, but really only when the support of the community is there saying, say what you want to say. You know, and only when she has a place from which to say it. So... one other story by Mary Wilkins Freeman, unless you want to say anything else about Hetty, which I'm happy to talk about.
I thought it was really cool that the home is a place for caring and nurturing.
Yeah.
And Hetty made the church her home, the caring and nurturing of the church, and how that parallels it became. The church became her home.
Yeah.
So she was the caring and nurturing of the community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
She becomes sort of this mother, maternal figure again. You know, we have these very maternal figures, but functioning in a slightly different way than sort of the traditional mother, you know. Yeah. She's a great character. So I would encourage you to read the whole story because it's fantastic.
Very emotional, it sounds like.
Well, it is for me. I don't know why. I think I just love that story so much.
Well, I think
inclusion
makes one.
Yes, and I just love.
I want to read more. Does she have other good books like that?
Oh yeah, she's got pastries, and this next one is also by her. So this other story is called A New England Nun, and maybe just think about that title for a little bit. What does that title suggest to you, or say to you, to be a New
Definitely
England
Catholic.
Okay.
And I suppose not in the majority in New England in that
okay.
day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, but
mm-hmm.
I think.
And there must be something special about being in New England.
Yes.
You wouldn't bother to say.
What if I were to tell you that this story really has nothing to do with religion or faith? What are other connotations of nun? Of a nun. What do we think of when we think of a nun?
They're single.
They're single.
They're isolated from the world.
Okay.
They dress differently.
Mm-hmm.
Did then.
Mm-hmm.
Very cloistered.
Cloistered.
Mm-hmm. Often underpaid.
Mm-hmm. Underpaid, yes.
They don't get paid.
Mm-hmm. They're in a submissive position to hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was kind of depository for people that were disenfranchised in some way or another.
My grandpa has a sister who became a nun. I don't even know her real name anymore because everyone just refers to her as Warsaw. Warsaw. I mean, she was, as far as I can tell, I never knew her, but a very disenfranchised woman that was difficult to get along with, but she became a nun, and I think a very good one. But
yeah.
Yeah. other connotations with that word.
Sometimes, I mean, I haven't read the story of you. Sometimes nuns in general can get a bad rap. The teachers, the nuns,
yes,
are the teachers and so on. You know, I you know, people have had those, some people have had those experiences.
Yes. Yeah, school experiences.
Some people have.
Yeah, oh, really?
Oh, dear. You might want to sit by Janet at dinner tonight.
You want to tell us your story.
Yeah, I'll tell you this story.
All right, so. So what you have here is the beginning of this story, a New England nun. So I'll just let you read it, and we'll discuss, and then I will share the end of it with you. Observations here, things you notice.
Was this the origin of a bull in a china shop?
It seems that way. I think the phrase, no, I don't think it was, but Freeman uses the phrase. So the next few lines, so she says, I'll pick them up after you're gone, after he's stumbled over these things. And then it says, when Joe Daggett was outside, he drew in the sweet evening air with a sigh and felt much as an innocent and perfectly well-intentioned bear might after his exit from a china shop. Louisa, on her part, felt much as the kind-hearted, long-suffering owner of the china shop might have done after the exit of the bear. Right, so it is definitely.
This author has quite a sense of humor.
Yes. So what do you notice here? How might you characterize Louisa?
Liturgy.
Liturgy, yeah, mm-hmm. Say more. What are you thinking?
Oh, well, a nun's life is very ordered. Mm-hmm. Everything in the right order during the day. Mm-hmm. Office hours.
Yeah, liturgy, ritual, routine, right? Things in their right place.
Protocol.
Do we have a sense of how old she is?
Well, she and Joe Daggett have been engaged for 15 years.
And is she the nun? nun? Is she a nun?
She is not a nun.
Oh, okay.
We, not...
Now.
Not...
Certifiably.
Right? I mean, not officially. Right?
Oh, I see.
But they have been engaged for 15 years, 14 of which he has been in Australia, trying to make his fortune, which was common at that time for men to leave and go try to, you know, make a fortune and then come back and marry. And she has been very patiently and, you know, properly waiting for his return. And now he has returned.
So this is his first return? I mean, or...
No, and we get the sense
okay.
that he has visited her before, but he has recently returned. And they are planning to marry soon. So...
She's going to have trouble with him.
Yeah, why?
She likes things in order, and he doesn't care. He doesn't think it makes any difference. I have the same problem. I've always been one. My house is never spotless, but I've always been one that picks up after, you know, and puts things back where I got them from. My husband is not.
You haven't trained him yet?
At 86, he's not trainable.
Oh, you can write a story.
Yeah.
I get his, he seemed to fill up the whole room.
Yeah.
You know, and I get the feeling that things are delicately in place.
Yeah.
There's order here. There's her little sanctuary, and it's beautiful. She loves beautiful things and to do things well. And so here comes this whole other big entity into the room and just fills it up. And you can feel the clashing of the two. He's almost a place in himself, you know, in a way. He's so, and I think he doesn't know what to do with himself, how to be in that place.
That's
a big bear.
He's a place in himself. That's interesting. So he imposes upon her space and takes it up. Even the canary is panicking.
The canary's panicking. Right.
which Freeman says was what the canary did every time Joe Daggett entered the house, right? This panic of this disruption of her space.
Do you think it's beautiful or cluttered? I guess it depends on the opinion of the person.
Yeah. The important thing.
I don't think her place is cluttered.
You don't think so?
No.
It's very
I mean,
ordered.
It might be. It
it's
might not
deliberate.
Be real orderly, but it's not cluttered. It's hers. It's her space.
Right.
That's
a lot
thing.
Of stuff. And he's come in and just kind of disarrayed things, and it just it.
But I don't think intentionally. I think
no.
he can't help it.
No.
No.
Right. That's my husband. He doesn't
yeah.
do it intentionally.
No.
But his space is here, and he you know throws papers on the floor. You know, and everything is up, and I'm trying to, and I have come to the conclusion, let's put it, I can't do it.
Yeah.
If he's going to be this way, it's going to be that way. You know, make him pick it up.
So it's really identifying with the story. Joe Daggett is just very male, and in that, in the beginning, everything is so beautiful. Even the flies dance. But when the laborers go by with their shovels, they plod. It's the one negative word in all of that, and it has to do with one assumes male.
Yeah.
So the male is so intrusive here, and there's something that's negative about it.
Come on, guys, defend our gender.
He doesn't sound like a guy who'd use fine china.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
He
doesn't
imagine him with a teacup in his hand.
I guess the thing that occurred to me was, in a way, it's a metaphor of any two people getting together. These two people were very different and had a lot of different habits, but any two people getting together have some pieces of china, some canaries. There's just something that.
Oh, yes.
She would be just as uncomfortable in his space.
Yes. Right.
Yes. And so we learn that in the story.
Oh, really?
So, and the other thing to keep in mind is that he has. has been away. He has been in Australia for 14 years. He has not been in this region either. And he has been in a place where he has changed. We can probably assume, right, that his experiences in Australia have likely changed him. And now he comes back. And Louisa has simply been
the same,
waiting and arranging her space to her liking, and hasn't probably changed much except to become more of herself.
Right.
Right? And suddenly now he is supposed to try to fit into that world. And when she marries him, she is expected to... When she marries him, if she marries him, she is expected to leave her home and go to his home. Whom he shares with her irritable mother. With his irritable mother.
That makes another...
And so...
Right?
And so she is to be dislocated, right? Taken out of her place, space, and put into his. And she is quite comfortable, clearly, in her own space. Now, the good news is, perhaps good news. Well, first of all, a few more things about Louisa and how scholars sort of deal with what's happening here. I mean, this is, again, a very domestic space that she's created for herself. Very, very feminine, right? And there's a lot of restraint in who she is, right? Again, that I mean, even just the calling her a nun suggests that there is restraint. And what scholars will say is that there is power in restraint, right? And which Freeman is trying to show with this character. That there's a certain amount of power that comes out of restraint. There's another scholar who talks about women regionalists writing out of compulsion. That this liturgy, this ritual, is kind of a compulsion. Like they can't help but repeat the same sort of patterns, put the book back in the same place, right? Drink out of the same teacup every day. But that there is story there, even as the wheels just kind of turn without going anywhere, that there is story there somehow. And perhaps a kind of power that comes out of that. That self-denial that she has as well is sort of also a self-indulgence, right? And she is indulging herself. She is treating herself as a guest in her own home in some ways.
I mean,
the way that she's sort of pampering herself, taking care of herself. So what happens then in the story is that mercifully for Louisa, she is walking along one night a week before she and Joe Daggett are to be married. And she overhears a conversation between Joe Daggett and Lily Dyer. Now, Lily Dyer is a young woman who has been taking care of his mother. And what Louisa overhears is a conversation that indicates that Joe and Lily are in love.
Oh.
But Joe is a man of his word and says, I will not go. I have promised Louisa for 15 years. I've been engaged to her. I will not go back on that. And Lily says, and I would not have you if you did. Right? Because I would not want to marry a man who would go back on his commitment and on his word. So Louisa, I'll read Freeman's words. Louisa sat there in a daze, listening to their retreating steps. After a while, she got up and slunk softly home herself. The next day, she did her housework methodically. That was as much a matter of course as breathing. But she did not sew on her wedding clothes. She sat at her window and meditated. In the evening, Joe came. Louisa Ellis had never known that she had any diplomacy in her. But when she came to look for it that night, she found it. Although meek of its kind, among her little feminine weapons. Even now, she could hardly believe that she had heard aright and that she would not do Joe a terrible injury should she break her troth plight. She went to sound him without betraying too soon her own inclinations in the matter. She she did it successfully, and they finally came to an understanding. But it was a difficult thing, for he was as afraid of betraying himself as she. She never mentioned Lily Dyer. She simply said that while she had no cause of complaint against him, she had lived so long in one way that she shrank from making a change.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good for her.
So she releases him,
yeah,
and frees herself.
Yes.
And so then he leaves. It says that night she and Joe parted more tenderly than they had done for a long time. And then all alone by herself that night, she wept a little. She hardly knew why. But the next morning on waking, she felt like a queen who, after fearing lest her domain be wrested away from her, sees it firmly insured in her possession. Right. And then finally, the last line then is, Louisa sat prayerfully numbering her days like an uncloistered nun. Mm. Like an uncloistered nun.
Wow.
The numbering days as if it were
rosary. Beautiful.
Yeah.
I love this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So does she, is she a short story reader?
Yeah. She wrote some novels, but she's mostly known for short stories.
So is there an anthology, like what we would look under a new, if you went to the library, is there an anthology of your books?
I mean, this is one of the best anthologies of just this
American
genre.
Women.
It's just called American Women Regionalists.
Okay.
And it has
a lot of these stories.
A lot of these stories in it. And then this is kind of a great companion piece, Writing Out of Place, that, you know, goes into detail in a lot of these stories and kind of analyzes them, interprets them. But, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think you might find some Freeman in the library, but it might be a difficult.
I know, but our library is so good. If I go in there and ask them for a book, they'll get it.
Yeah.
That's really neat, too, because then some more people will get it.
Right.
And quite often, if you put the author's name in, there will be some anthologies that have her stories in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In other collections.
Right.
So, yeah. What is particularly regional about these stories other than where the women live?
Yeah. That's a good question, because Freeman is not describing really the character of the place so much. She's writing late enough, sort of, in this that she doesn't have to describe New England. It's been described well enough. By previous writers, and so I guess what I would say, what makes it regional, is this notion of women creating a space for themselves from which they can speak and sort of make decisions for themselves. Yeah. Yeah. Anything else? Well, thanks for sharing these two of these favorite stories with me.
Thank you.